Think you got it?
We'll call the Commerce Committee to order. We've got two bills on the agenda this morning, or this afternoon. Is it 1967, Senator Desick?
I thought that
was a good year for something. Wireless communication devices, acquisition, resale requirements, establishment. Senator Desick, you may. Then the second bill will be a short bill that I have. Senate File 1689, Minnesota Fair Plan Employees Benefit Authorization. So, Senator Desick, welcome to the committee. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for hearing this bill. Senate File 1964 limits purchase and acquisition of cell phone and other electronic devices. Since last fall, there have been several high-profile assaults involving theft of electronic devices. Many of us don't realize that we're walking around with valuable equipment from $200 to $1,000. Yes, in some stores allow the bad guys to assault people. Literally, as you're texting on the bus, they'll come by and literally take the phone and hop off. And then they'll go and take these devices to either a kiosk or the store, and they'll get cash. This is not specific to Minneapolis. The FCC estimates that 30 to 40% of all theft involves theft of electronic devices. Last year, I was at a meeting with several of these people to discuss some of these issues, and we asked the police what could be done to stop it. And they said, stop the cash. Stop the quick availability of cash so that these are not worth as much. That got me thinking, and I remembered that in about 2008, the legislature changed the law so that you can't walk into scrap metals and get cash for scrap metal. And as a result of the bill that changed the where you can no longer get scrap metal for cash, those sales have dropped, and theft of scrap metal has dropped, and theft of copper has dropped. So we kind of thought, well, let's look at that and at least have the discussion if we take – and we, so we literally copied the scrap metal bill, put it in here, tweaked it so it's more applicable to electronic devices, and that's what we have before us. The bill prohibits – the bill in this law prohibits cash for electronic devices, and then it also outlines other requirements to deter criminals and help law enforcement. The goal is not to overly burden law-abiding citizens and law-abiding stores, but to hinder and stop some of the assaults and thefts. I forwarded the bills to representatives of law enforcement, several cell phone companies, and retailers, and have had conversations with them, and I thank them for their input. With me today is Minneapolis City Councilmember Jacob Fry, Minneapolis Deputy Police Chief Christine Arnson, and U of M Police Chief Greg Hessness to discuss the problem in the bill. With that, I'll ask them to say a few words. And
Senator
then,
Desick.
Yes.
It's all right. I think we'll put the bill in the shape you'd like it in, and that's
okay.
The amendment you have here. Is that correct?
Yes, the A3 amendment.
That's the A3 amendment. So
I'll move that.
Senator Pappas moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you. And now we'll go to, is it Mr. Fry first?
Yes, Councilmember Fry.
Thank you,
Welcome
Mr.
Here,
Chair.
Councilman.
Members of the committee, I am the council member for Minneapolis, the third ward, which includes downtown Minneapolis as well as parts of the university in Northeast. And this is becoming an increasingly pervasive issue, not just for Minneapolis, but the entire country. 40% of the thefts in Minneapolis, 40% are a result of our cell phone thefts. That is a dramatic figure, and just given the very nature of cell phone thefts, a vast majority of them are somewhat either violent or the threat of violent in nature, because you have to have your cell phone on you. Generally, these individuals are walking around looking at them or talking into them, and they get mugged. It's a major problem, and you especially see this around the University of Minnesota and in parts of downtown. You've had 1.6 million cell phone thefts in this last year, and that's about a $3 billion value. So, I mean, this is a pretty serious issue that we're dealing with right now. So we're asking that although the industry may be reluctant, we're asking them to make changes, and these changes have been asked before. Once with regard to copper, the copper industry, copper is, of course, a very expensive material. And once the changes were in place, the number of copper thefts went down from approximately 350 in 2008 to 150 today. Dramatic drop, and it just took just minor changes in the law. The second one where this happened was automobile theft back in the 1990s, and because of the changes that the industry made, automobile thefts are far less of an issue today. So there are a few minor changes. I believe Senator Zietzik highlighted all of them, and I will certainly stand for questions.
Okay, any questions of Councilman Frye? Senator Kosoka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few questions. One, do any other states already do what you're trying to do, either to Senator Dietzick or the testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Zelka, not to my knowledge. I did have conversations with NCSL, and then we did some research, and I know that the, in New York they've introduced some bills, and mostly they are just requiring the database of the ID on the phones and to help keep track of that, kind of copying what Senator Schumer has introduced nationally. But I mean, I personally spent a lot of time, and my staff spent some time researching what other states are doing, including calling, you know, NCSL, and we didn't get anything.
Okay. A few questions, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kosoka.
Senator Dietzick, do we know, you know, when a phone is stolen or not, and somebody goes to get cash for it, roughly how much do they get paid for that phone?
My understanding, and the police may have a better may be able to talk to that a little more, but my understanding, the kiosk in Roseville is anywhere from $50 to $400.
Okay.
And it can go higher for other electronic devices like your iPad.
Yep. And, Mr. Chair, a couple questions related to the bill. So who then has to keep the records? How does that work?
Right now the bill, I believe the stores themselves, or the companies themselves, would keep the records. Some of them are already collecting a lot of this data, and so it might just be, you know, a little bit additional data.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, is anybody from the industry going to testify? This really, I read through it, and, you know, yes, it's a simple thing in the law to make a change, but we potentially pass a lot of expense on to those that we're making do this. And so it might be simple to us, but I'm hoping we can hear, Mr. Chair, what the ramifications are for those that actually have to gather the documentation.
Yeah, we've just handed a list of about three testifiers from the phone area. So, Senator Dietzick.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Zelka, I have had conversations with them, and I understand that they have some concerns, and I will continue to have conversations if we get through this committee. There's two other committees that we will be before, and I have told them that, and I'd like to continue working with them. And that's why I said that I understand that there's a lot of law-abiding citizens in stores and retailers and cell phone companies that are not the problem, and so how do we, and I've asked them to help me figure out how do we target, and again, the police can give you a better idea here of some of the entities that we're dealing with, how do we target them without being overly burdensome on everybody else?
Thank you.
Okay, we can hear from your other witnesses if you'd like.
Okay, I have with me, we'll start with Deputy Police Chief Christine Arneson.
You're welcome.
Good afternoon. How are you? Thank you for letting me speak today. And Councilmember Frye did outline several items that were, in fact, very true and that we see in Minneapolis. He mentioned that 40% of our thefts are from these cell phones, but also that 40% of our street robberies are from cell phones and iPad devices. We're looking to create public policy that would help us regulate these phones, such as our automated pawn system, which has worked very well in Minneapolis, where if you pawn something, you do have to go in and show your identification, and your name goes into the database, and it's looked at. Also, we're able to see if that item is stolen right away, so that's very helpful. We always ask our cell phone users to be very, very aware of their environment. But again, if people have an opportunity to not sell that phone to someone who will buy it up to, as the senator said, up to $400, then that capacity for them to want to even steal the phone in the first place and sell it really is reduced, thus protecting consumers all around. So I just want to support this bill. I think it would be very helpful in the city of Minneapolis in helping us reduce thefts and these robberies on the street, which unfortunately do lead to violent actions. Thank you.
Sir, from Minnesota College.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg Hustis, Police Chief of the University of Minnesota. I want to speak in support of Senator Dedzic's bill, of course. I also want to thank the leadership of the university and the legislature for the priority they've placed on the safety of students. It's a top priority for President Kaler and UMPD as well. Great note was taken of the uptick in robbery of University of Minnesota students this past fall. Some on campus, predominantly off campus in the neighborhoods. In fact, we know there's a predictable increase in all sorts of activity in the fall term, but this year the robbery was 27% higher than the five-year average. So that was notable, but beyond that, there were some other factors that were of great concern. There was a display of firearms in 50% of the cases, and that's an increase. The actual use of force was more frequent. The scenarios of multiple attackers and multiple victims was an increase. We usually tell students don't walk alone. That isn't a guarantee in these cases. And cellular smartphones were the loss in the entire loss or part of the loss in a great majority of cases. I'll say more about that. So the university's responded in a variety of ways. Obviously, we've done a lot on the enforcement side, working with Minneapolis, hundreds of hours of overtime off campus in the neighborhoods. We've also had support from Hennepin Sheriff, from Transit, from the State Patrol as well, and our president's authorized over 750 hours of overtime for my department. We've worked plainclothes, uniform details, targeting predatory behaviors. Multiple arrests have been made, including robbery, weapons, warrants, other offenses. In fact, 2 a.m. New Year's morning, we interrupted a robbery in progress. They didn't take a break for the holiday. So we do believe we've sent a message that predatory behavior in the neighborhoods is not risk-free around the university. Gone through education on campus, strong partnerships with student government, particularly the Minnesota Student Association, GAPS, the Graduate Professional Association. Unlike a municipality, we have to really re-educate our about a quarter of our constituents turn over every year, so it's kind of constant re-education. We've worked on the environment on campus. We made immediate improvements to lighting. President Kaler has redirected some of the improvement and maintenance dollars towards security for access control, surveillance, et cetera. So we're going after in a variety of ways. And finally, engagement, particularly off campus. We've had many public forums trying to raise the awareness. Forums like this were very helpful. And working with city government, business, and property owners, as well as on safety enhancements and just better communication amongst ourselves. Still, with all these strategies, there's room for innovation, such as Senator Dedzic's bill. And I believe the legislation shows promise for reducing the risk to students. It's been mentioned what percentage of robberies involve the theft of cell phones. Nationally, I guess it's 1 in 3. I tracked this in September 1st, and the campus area robberies, it was 62% of the cases involved a cell phone theft or robbery. So our Big Ten law enforcement peers report similar. Offenders usually presume with good cause that college students are normally in possession of valuable, readily disposable to this point, pieces of technology. So I believe this step towards seller and buyer accountability legislation will greatly undermine the profit motive for these crimes, reduce the risk of victimization, make our students safer. It really is not just about the property. It really is about the personal safety of university students. So thank you.
Yeah, that's certainly what's important. I mean, $50 is not the end of the world, but people getting hit over the head for a $40, $50 phone is just not good. So any questions, Senator Brown?
Mr. Chairman, this question would be for any of the testifiers. If a thief is arrested for stealing a wireless communications device, what's the punishment for that crime?
Sir?
Yep. Well, it would depend on the manner in which it was stolen. If it was a simple theft, it would be on the value of the device. If we're taken with force, as in a robbery, it would be much more severe. It would be a felony level.
All right. Any further questions? Claire Letts.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a co-author on the bill, so I certainly encourage people to support it. Just do you have any idea how much cash are the sellers getting for some of these devices at the kiosks or wherever? I mean, I know what my cell phone plan. You know, they give it the phone to you as a part of a special deal to sign up for the contract. But if you got to replace it, it can be gross misdemeanor level theft value, you know, for some of these devices. I mean, so do you have any idea these $40 or $50 phones or the $750 personal communication devices?
Senator DC.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Latz. My phone, I think, was $299, $399 when I got it. And when I went to the kiosk, and it's 2 years old, when I went to the kiosk, I think it was $50. And so, you know, it's $299. The replacement value, $299. I think I got it for $299. I think it was $399. The replacement value is not going to be, it's going to be more than that. And it was $50. I think the newer versions are the one. I think your iPads and your iPod. Mine is not an iPod, it's a, or iPad, it's a Samsung Galaxy. So it was $50, but I think the newer versions, I mean, they really do, you know, up to $400.
Well, the new ones, Mr. Chair, the new ones are telling you you're going to have to, if you want to replace it, it's $600, which is why, you know, gross misdemeanor, you get over $500. Mm-hmm. So, you know, are they, they're probably getting, if they're pretty new, they're probably getting several hundred dollars at the kiosks in cash.
Quick cash. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Senator Kasoka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dzik, line 1.17, every person, the beginning of that. So is that anybody that's buying a used phone has to keep all these records, or is there, am I missing something there? Oh, sorry. Delete all.
Here.
Forgive
okay.
me. My bad. I'll come back to that in a second.
Here's the delete all.
We're working up the new language.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, I believe it's the wireless communication device dealer would keep this data. Some of them are already collecting a lot of the information.
Okay, any further questions? Okay, we're going to let you guys take a little break, or not necessarily the author, but the other ones, and then we'll have Mr. Peter Coyle. Up next, and then Paul Wirtz, AT&T, and Bruce Newsted. So the retailers on deck. Welcome to the committee, and always state your name for the records. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Peter Coyle. I'm a lawyer with Larkin Hoffman, and I represent T-Mobile this morning.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Paul Wirtz. I'm the state president for AT&T Minnesota.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members, very briefly, first of all, I want to commend the author for raising what's obviously a very important issue in the state and around the country. Certainly T-Mobile, among one carrier, shares her concern about it, and we certainly want to try to work with her to find a solution that can fit everybody, you know, using the cliche of measure twice, cut once. We'd really like to just cut once. There are multiple proposals out there, including in this legislature right now, to deal with cell phone theft, and we want to make sure that at the end of the day, the product that gets enacted, if any, is one that can work for everybody, including the retailers. In T-Mobile's case, they have 36 corporate stores in Minnesota, and they have 14 that are licensed to sell T-Mobile products as T-Mobile stores. And then we, of course, like other carriers, market our products through multiple national retailers and some independents. We've got a couple of concerns with the bill, and I indicated to Senator Dzik this morning that we did have concerns, that, and yet we've continued to hope to work with her as time allows this session. I'll just touch on a couple of them, and Mr. Wirtz can comment as he chooses as well. First of all, with respect to record keeping, we do ask people to sign a document when they sell a phone to us at our store, but we do not require that they sign it under a penalty of perjury because, frankly, we're a retailer. We're not a law enforcement entity, and we're uncomfortable being put in a position where we're taking on a law enforcement role. So that's a policy question I recognize for the state, but that's a problem for us just as a procedural matter, so I wanted you to know that. Secondly, with respect to document release, The legislation is very permissive in the sense that if a law enforcement officer asks us to disclose customer information, the legislation would compel us to. That creates a huge problem for us under federal law where we have privacy constraints. And frankly, to just cut it to the chase, absent a subpoena from a court, we'd be in a very difficult position to release any customer information because of privacy concerns. So that's an issue that we're going to have to find a way to work through if there's going to be a bill. Thirdly, with respect to the process where there's a hold place, the legislation as drafted now requires that there be probable cause. I presume that would be probable cause as indicated by a judge rather than just an officer representing that to us. But the issue that it raises is the hold requirement. We're now being put in a position where we have to hold evidence that could be used in a criminal proceeding, and I understand why. But the problem is the transaction will already have occurred with the person that brought the phone in, and we're going to presume that that person acted in good faith because we don't know any better at that point. But so we've consummated the transaction, and now we're being put in a position where we have to basically suffer the consequences of that from a financial standpoint, and we can't resell the device through whatever channel we would ordinarily do that through. We have to wait until the hold period is released, which could be up to 15 days or perhaps longer if there's actually a criminal case that comes forward. So there's an issue where we've advanced credit to this person, and then subsequently we're advised that there may be a criminal element to this that we did not know about at that time. So there's a financial risk area there that I'll just be candid that we're not comfortable with right now, and that's certainly something that we'll want to have more conversation about. And then lastly, there is a carve-out that's been added into the legislation that while on first blush it sounds like it might actually work, in reading it more carefully at subdivision 8, lines 4.17 and 4.19, it allows for a customer to return a phone that they purchased through the retailer. The issue that that raises to me is you could have that person who stole the phone, brought it back to us, and while we can't give them cash for the phone based on the bill, they could buy the phone, and as I read the language, come back the next day, and they could convert it for cash by simply returning it to us. And so the accomplishment of the cash outlay would still seem to be there. And so it seems like it's not accomplishing perhaps what the author has intended. So I'm not sure whether that's a good thing or bad thing, but frankly, I just saw it as an anomaly and wanted to raise it. Mr. Chairman, those are my comments, and I certainly could answer questions if there are any for me.
Sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. If I may, I'd like to walk the committee through our trade-in program process because I think it really gets to some of the concerns with the bill. But I want to commend Senator Dietzick for drawing attention to a very serious issue. Just last week, we launched with Sheriff Stanek our Protect My Cell Phone initiative. This is a serious issue. We take cell phone safety and theft with our customers and with consumers very seriously. But this initiative is being launched, was launched here in the Twin Cities. It promises to go statewide, and we're actually in discussions about taking this education and awareness campaign nationally. AT&T's trade-in program allows wireless device owners to trade in their own old phones in exchange for an AT&T promotional card that is only used for AT&T wireless services or products. Now, this is also other phones that might come into our store, not necessarily AT&T customers, but they can only use that for an AT&T product or service. The other portion of that is if a customer chooses to waive that promotional card and service, they can donate the phone, and then that is given to Cell Phones for Soldiers in lieu of receiving that promotional card, and that goes to benefit our men and women overseas. Before offering the promotional gift card, we do a number of checks on the device to make sure, and this is called an IMEI. It's basically a code that's applied to every cell phone in the country. And that IMEI is looked at and compared to the stolen phone's database to make sure that that phone has not been stolen previously and reported on that database because it then could not be activated by any carrier's network. We do not resell those phones in the state of Minnesota. Those phones are then sent to a facility in Indiana where they then, again, a second time, compare that to the stolen phone's database to make sure that it has not come up as a stolen phone. And then those usable devices, once they're kind of refurbished, are used as insurance replacement phones or promotional devices. They're not sold back into the mainstream, if you will, of the retail mainstream. We also require, I think my colleague mentioned this earlier, some type of acknowledgement on the part of the customer when they return the phones. Every customer must sign a receipt containing the AT&T trade-in program terms and conditions, which provide in part that the owner of the phone is the sole and rightful owner of the device being traded in. They are not trading in a stolen or lost device, and the device is free of any liens or claims by third parties. So we think there are a number of practices in place to really safeguard some of that stolen phone activity, but certainly we're committed to working with Senator Dietzick and working through the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Question. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What other technological options are available to cell phone owners to disable their phones or diminish phone value after theft?
Sir.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, part of this, we brought some attention to this at actually our cell phones safety event last week. There are a number of devices that are across the spectrum of cell phones now. You have the Apple device, you have the Google device, Android device, Microsoft. There are about 30 different applications that consumers can use that will help them to safeguard their data, remotely wipe their device. We view this as very much a campaign, if you will, of education and awareness of the technology that is already there.
Okay. Senator Lance.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you. It sounds like you've got a pretty robust system in place through your network of stores and so on. I get the sense that the greater concern this bill is attempting to address are those kiosks in the malls that aren't necessarily affiliated with any cell phone company like yours or any of the others that are out there, AT&T, Sprint, Verizon, the whole bit.
Don't forget T-Mobile.
And T-Mobile. So how do you suggest, as public policymakers, we address the concerns with those kiosks that may not have as robust a system in place to protect against the use or reuse of stolen phones?
Mr. Chairman, Mayor. Senator, I'll take a stab at it, and Mr. Wirtz can comment as he chooses. One of the most promising ideas that we're participating in involves the development of a database that's been released within the last 3 or 4 months, whereby a phone can be registered on it, and if it's identified as being stolen, it can be shut down. And in our mind, that's a universal solution. It doesn't pick a state boundary. I mean, one of the concerns as a practical matter we have is that this legislation, if it were adopted, wouldn't apply in Wisconsin or Iowa or the Dakotas. So you'll just take that stolen phone and go across the border, and you'll be able to do exactly what you are concerned about is happening in Minnesota. The national database solution that's been developed in our mind, while it's not international in scope yet, our objective would be to have it be international, and to the degree that we can have a streamlined process that allows that to be a choke point where the phone can be rendered useless, that to us seems to be a practical solution that ought to be given a chance to work.
Senator Lance.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Coyle, one of the reasons I signed on to this bill instead of another bill like what you're describing is precisely because of my concern about the potential misuse of such a national database, including the risk of electronic hacking into that database from, well, anywhere in the world and the kind of havoc that they can wreak. Shutting down, registering and shutting down all sorts of cell phones that really weren't stolen and were not sought by to be shut down by the true owner of the cell phone. So it seemed to me there's some great risk. You get a choke point. You concentrate a lot of power either in the hands of very few persons, companies, potentially even the federal government, and then it's at risk for hacking and intrusion that creates all sorts of other issues as well. So I certainly, in an ideal world, maybe that would be a nice system to have, but, you know, we don't have I'm not sure I'm comfortable going that direction, which is one reason I support Senator Dietzick's approach. And maybe it needs some fine-tuning, and maybe we need to get Wisconsin to pass a similar law. But those are my thoughts on that. I'd be curious as to your reaction.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, even if you mentioned earlier the kiosks, if you will, if those are cell phones, new cell phones there that are being sold, they also have that IMEI imprint on that device. So that is unique to every cell phone sold in America. So if that IMEI comes up on that stolen phone database, that cannot be activated by any carrier in the country. That database just went online in November. The industry, very much in cooperation with law enforcement, created this stolen phone database. To your point about kind of the hacking notion, if you will, that has been kind of the industry's concern about a one-size-fits-all kill switch notion. And there was some testimony last week on that in the House that applying a single technology over the spectrum of carriers, manufacturers, and operating systems would only then invite, you know, some of the cyber terrorism, if you will, that would get at these devices. You could disable, you know, entire police forces because everybody's on a standard kind of kill switch notion. But that's some of the issues that were raised in testimony by the industry association last week, and we'd be happy to get you a copy of that.
Senator DC.
Mr. Chair, thank you. When I was researching the bill, and I appreciate their testimony, and I appreciate your questions, when I was researching some of this, the national database list that just went on board in November, there is some concern by some senators in the U.S. Senate that it's taking too long and that also there's not teeth to it. So I believe there are some bills out there where they add a few more penalties to it and possibly even some money, because there is some concern that it just won't be entered quick enough, so just funding to help get it up and running. And so, again, that was another reason why I took this low-tech approach. It might not solve all the answers. It might not be the, you know, an answer at all, but it's just a thought to get out there to have this discussion of what other ideas are out there and what other options are out there, because, again, it's not the $50 that somebody gets. It's, you know, it's the beating up. It's a concussion. It's being held at gunpoint that is causing the problems. So I thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, members.
Senator Kosoko, just a second.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Dzik, but also the testifiers there, I hear you guys talking, and it seems like you guys could find common ground.
Yeah.
And, you know, because I think what you're trying to do, I support. I just don't want it to go the wrong direction. And so I'm hoping that you guys can figure that out and do it. And if you think there's common ground for us to do it, you know, either it goes through the next committee or you lay it over. I don't care either way. But that's the commitment I need to know, is that you guys will truly do that. We do that on a lot of issues, and I think this is another one that should be done that way.
Senator Kosoko, I've had that conversation with the senator, and she's assured me that we're not done here today.
Correct. I would
work in progress. And,
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Gazelka. That is my plan, and I've told them, and I've told the retailers and others interested that I'd like to keep having these conversations, including with law enforcement, because I think there is a lot of common ground here, and I think there are some options in here. We continue our discussions that we can come to an agreement. Again, it might not be the answer to everything, but I think if it stops and deters somebody, I think that's a good start. And so I've you know, agreed to continue to meet with them. As I said earlier, there's two more stops after this meeting, and so committees, I'm in Senator Sparks's committee and then also Senator Ladd's Judiciary. So, and I would like to, you know, if possible, and if you agree, to move out of this committee and then continue discussions with them as we go forward into the next two committees and hopefully come to a resolution that we can all agree upon.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dzik, I would appreciate what Senator Gazelka and Metzen have talked about. And I do agree, it appears that there is some opportunity for common ground here. And I'm assuming it'll probably come to the Ag Jobs and Rural Development next. So what I would ask is that you folks get together and get things ironed out before it comes to that committee, even if it means delaying it a few days or a week or two before it comes to that committee, because I think it's very important that I get a little nervous when we send legislation out of one committee to the next committee based on it's going to get fixed. I like to see it fixed before it goes out of this committee, but as it's laying, that probably won't happen. So I would like to know for sure that that's what's going to happen, is it's going to be fixed and resolved before we see it in the Ag and Jobs Committee. So thank you.
You know, I agree. You heard me many times before say we this is the only place we get to hear this stuff. So this is our bite of the apple, so we try to fix it up here. But these time constraints were faced. And then sometimes in this world you have to take the author's word that she's going to continue to work. And we've got Commerce, which you should be here. But actually the telecom is underneath the ag jurisdiction, so we can either pass it here without recommendation or pass it with recommendation on to the next committee. I think those are our two options today. I don't think we have the luxury of I agree with you, Senator Davis, but I suppose we better keep her moving. Because something's got to be done in this area. I mean, I don't think there's a person in the room that doesn't agree with that, but it's just how we get there is what we're trying to strive for. Senator Kisalka?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, to concur with what Senator Dame said, I'm willing to vote for yes today as long as that commitment is what you talked about. And it may not be that it's exactly what you want, but we've done a lot of good bills here lately where we get a lot done because we're all working together.
That's the Commerce Committee. We try to work together. We've got another, Senator, we have another witness. This is Mr. Newstead.
Thank you.
How do we hear from the retailers? And I get his view on these.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, welcome.
Mr. Chair, my name is Bruce Newstead. I'm staff president of the Minnesota Retailers Association. We're a collection of about 1,500 storefronts across Minnesota, representing retailers of all different shapes and sizes, from your mom-and-pop Main Street retailers up to your retailers that serve customers across the country from multiple locations. So to your question, Senator Kisalka, we certainly see that there's some common ground on this bill. Some work to be done on language from our perspective. We're concerned with today we have some very responsible retailers in this area. In fact, you just heard from a couple of them. And we just want to make sure we separate out what our responsible retailers are doing today to those that we're really trying to reach with this language to make sure the language is good for everybody but gets the job done. We recognize that retailers are a component of this problem, not that we're part of the problem. We're a component in the problem. Thus, we have a responsibility to work on a solution as well. Many retailers in the state, most if not all of my members that I asked about this issue, have come back with a great selection of best practices that they put in place in their organizations. You heard from AT&T, their process. It is not uncommon for a responsible retailer in this area to talk about documenting the seller, getting a government-issued ID, to talk about adequately documenting the device that's being sold, because if you don't capture anything unique on that device, you'll never be able to identify it as stolen. And then maintaining records and keeping some great relationship with law enforcement. In fact, some retailers are even regulated at the local level through some of the practices. Even if you think of like a pawn type operation that has some local regulation, usually as a part of a regulatory compliance or a permit there at the local level, they'll be using the state's APS system, a system used to track seller information and unique identifiers about a particular device. So today I just wanted to reinforce what those before me said is we're certainly appreciative and willing to work with the author on some of the particularities surrounding this bill. Our concern is to make sure we don't inhibit a great practice that's going on today, take back or resale or trade-in is a real important part of the sustainability process for retailers today. And it also, by the way, gives great access to technology, new technology to consumers, and makes it a bit more affordable. So there's great reasons for trade-in programs. There's some great best practices out there today. We would just want to make sure that those that aren't abiding by any form of best practices are the ones that this bill reaches as opposed to those that are responsible retailers in this area.
Okay. Any further... Senator Disick.
I'll be short. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have agreed to work with them, and I've actually talked to some of the retailers and asked them that I know majority of them are not the problem, but you do have some. It's not just the kiosks. There are some rogue stores that are part of the problem, and asked the retailers, help me figure out how can we, you know, what can we do to get at them that, you know, doesn't burden everybody else. And so I have asked them and have agreed to work with them to get to the problem.
Co-author Senator Latz, would you care to move this bill? And it'll be going to the GovOps, Jobs, Ag, Rural Development Committee.
Sure, yeah. I move that Senate file.
Jobs, I should say. Yep.
1964 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the
Jobs
Committee.
Okay. Any further questions? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you very much. And
thank you.
Good luck. Get it worked out.
All right. Thank
you. Paul, would you sit here for a minute?
What do I do?
I know he's got a lot of points.
Yeah.
Did everyone get the? Because we had transposed numbers here.
Senator Betson, welcome to your committee.
Everybody got it. Okay. Just want to make sure that we're all looking at the same thing.
Are those the numbers?
I'd love a copy. Thank you.
Are there some financial numbers?
No.
Senator Betson will be presenting Senate File 1689. Senator Betson.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate File 1689 is a Fair Plan Employment Employee Legislation. Pretty simple bill. It allows 12 employees of the Fair Plan to join the state health plan. The employees will pay 100% of the premiums, and there is no cost to the state. It's fashioned after the joint underwriting, JUA, a similar entity that has legislation authorized its employees to purchase their own insurance through the state health plan. So it involves 12 people from the Fair Plan, and I have Mr. Dan Johnson, the executive director of the Fair Plan, with me today, and former State Representative Bert McAsee, dear friend of mine, at the table also. So, Mr., with your indulgence, Senator, or Mr. Johnson would like to visit with the committee.
Welcome, Mr. Johnson. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Daniel Johnson. I am the executive director of the Minnesota Fair Plan. For the members of the audience who are not acquainted with us, we were created by the legislature in 1969 to provide people with the opportunity to buy property insurance when they cannot get it through the private market. We currently have about 6,000 customers that fall into that category. The purpose of this bill is, as mentioned, just to allow our organization to go through the state to procure our health insurance. We are currently under the Small Business Health Reform Act, which is far more costly and has other underwriting considerations that make it more difficult for our organization and our employees. So we're hoping that the committee will see clear to allow the change in the wording, allowing us to purchase insurance through the same place that the state and other agencies do. I guess that's about it. There are questions.
Yeah, Mr. Johnson or McAsee, what happened in the last few years that has caused this shift? I know there's some reasons why, and I guess I'd want you to.
When I first came on board with the Fair Plan, which was some 15 years ago, at the time we were allowed to purchase insurance through our National Association of Fair Plans. It's called the Property Insurance Plan Services Office. We were then converted to the Small Business Health Reform Act coverage, which basically meant that we were paying about $50,000 more a year to get the same exact coverage we had while we were purchasing through the big group. We also were then required to go through age banding, and also our experience was just that of our small group of people rather than the group that comprised thousands of covered lives prior to that through our association. We were unable to find, let's say, agreement in the interpretation of the Small Business Health Reform Act. So this is our alternative, is to simply ask for the same wording that the JUA was granted when it was created some years after we were.
Mr. McAsee, any other comments?
Nothing, Mr. Chairman. Just appreciate the committee's consideration.
Thank you. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. I don't know how many people total, if it's just the 12 people that would be affected by this, but is MinSure not an option for these people?
We have not explored MinSure as far as that's that goes, we provide the employer, as the employer, we provide coverage. So if I understand correctly, we would have to stop doing that, for starters, for our MNSHR, for people to qualify for that, is my understanding. But we provide it as a basic benefit. We're simply looking for a way to provide that basic benefit at a lower cost. In the final analysis, the fare plan, if we run out of money, we have the power to assess all the member companies, which means that that assessment will be passed on to the consumers of insurance in the state. We hope to forestall that day when we have to do an assessment by trying to keep our expenses down, and this is one way, health insurance being a very significant portion of any budget, this would be one way that we could help reduce our costs and hopefully forego an assessment for more years.
And Mr. Johnson, you said the JUA is, how many employees do they have?
They are smaller, to my knowledge. I don't know exactly how many, but I know it's less than the fare plan.
And Mr. Johnson, they're already doing what you're trying to do?
Yes, that is correct. They have, it's right in their enabling legislation allowing them to do this. Just to clarify, we do have 12 employees. However, not all 12 will be joining because one of our employees in particular is married. His spouse works for the state, and so he's with the state program already. Another of our employees is insured through her husband's health insurance, so it would not be all 12 that would be coming over. But it is true that we would be paying the full bill as the employer, that we would not require any contribution from any other source.
All right. I believe Bruce Anderson from MMB is going to testify against this bill. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yep. Please come forward.
He shouldn't, but he's going to.
I know.
Just kidding.
I'm against it.
No, he's not.
Good. How are you?
Mr. Anderson, state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bruce Anderson. I'm the manager of the State Employee Group Insurance Program, also known as CGIP, and also the Public Employers Insurance Program, also called PEEP. And I'm here today to speak on behalf of CGIP. We're opposed to allowing the Fair Plan employees to participate in CGIP because, as we understand it, they're not state employees. Adding non-state employees to CGIP is a very important decision and one we don't take lightly. CGIP is a single governmental plan, and that status will change if we allow more than a de minimis number of non-state employees to participate. Changing the plan status will result in being subject to additional regulations like ERISA, reporting requirements, and duties which will raise the cost of operating CGIP. The state, including the legislature, would lose a significant amount of control over the plan. We will likely also lose our status as a single employer group, causing it to become a multi-employer plan, again, which is a whole different set of laws and regulations which we would have to follow. We do realize that the Minnesota Fair Plan is similar to certain current group members, such as the Joint Underwriters Association. However, that program was added to the to CGIP prior to legal analysis that was done that showed CGIP was a governmental entity. And if existing CGIP groups with non-governmental employees were seeking membership today, we would object on the same grounds as I just described. In today's healthcare market, Minnesota Fair Plan employees can attain good and affordable coverage either through MNSHR or directly through insurance carriers operating in the state. MNSHR has a plan called the State Business Health Option Program, also called SHOP, which is set up just for employers like Minnesota Fair. So we believe these choices are appropriate avenues for Minnesota Fair and for the plan organization. So thank you for your consideration.
So, Mr. Anderson, I've got a question for you.
You want to talk?
You listed some possible ramifications if these 12 employees were added in, or 10 or whatever it is. Why did those ramifications not take place when JUA is in there? I mean, to me, it's the similar situation. So why did those things not happen when they're in there, and somehow they're going to happen if we add these in there?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. One of the reasons is, as I mentioned, we can allow a de minimis number in, and that's very loosely determined, but it's between 0.5% and 1% of employees. So you know, we're not sure if we're bumping up right to there, but, you know, we'd rather not because, again, that could change the status of our program, but that's one of the reasons why.
So if it's a half a percent of all the employees to be, we're going to be way, way below that number.
But we do, like I said, we do have other non-government entities in there right now, like the Historical Society and things of that nature.
Okay. Mr. McCassie.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that, well, first of all, this is the first that we have heard of the objection, and the bill's been in for a couple weeks. But it seems to me that if they are dealing with the JUA and the Minnesota Historical Society, and that isn't causing any great problems, that to take 10 more people from the FAIR plan, which is a very valuable quasi-state entity, should not really cause them a problem in the big picture.
Thank you. Before I get to which one was it? Senator Brown, I've been informed that a fiscal note has been requested, and if this is passed out of committee, it'll be addressed in finance. So,
correct.
Was it Senator Brown? Did you, or Senator Dames?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, is your concern really adding the additional 10 people, or is it setting precedent that we're starting to bring in more groups? And you say you have two of them now, JUA and the Historical Society. Are there any other ones?
Mr. Chair and Senator, there's a handful of other groups right now off the top of my head. I think one might be the there's just a handful of other groups that are in the program right now that are non-governmental entities. I think both of the points that you brought up are valid. One is coming up to the de minimis amount, and then also setting a precedent that other similar employers could follow the same path.
Mr. Chairman, that's already been set, though. I mean, that's kind of history. So, you know, there's strength in numbers. We're talking thousands and thousands of state employees, and we're talking 10 people. And it's a quasi-state agency that we created. It's been done before. And I think the good commissioner's making a bigger, lot bigger deal out of this than he has to. And I would encourage you to pass this for these 10 people. It's a fairness thing, too.
Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to direct this to the commissioner. You'd mentioned MNsure. This body spent a great deal of time last year creating MNsure for very instances like this. Is this group as an employer, would they not be eligible to use MNsure as an option for their employees?
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, it would be.
I would encourage, Mr. Chairman, Senator, that you should look at all options. Who's ever, yeah. I'm not looking at you, I guess, but I think we could probably have that in our radar.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, just as a statement, I just find it incredible that the amount of work we put into MNsure, and it seems now that we have it, nobody wants it.
Senator Brown, point well taken.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Letts.
It seems to me we're going well beyond the scope of this bill into other political comments that are unnecessary and non-germane to this debate. I'd appreciate if the chair would reflect that rather than encouraging it.
Senator Letts, point well taken. Any other questions? Senator Pappas.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if state and local government has requested this bill yet, but it does seem to me, in light of Mr. Anderson's concerns, that if we do vote to pass it, we should probably send it there.
Well, Senator Metzen, would you like to?
That's fine with me. We'll make that motion to move it to the
Senate File 1689 be recommended to pass and be referred to
state
and local government.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Carries.
Thank you very much.
Is he coming back?
See you later.
One final announcement. We will meet next Wednesday, and we are officially adjourned if Senator Metzen doesn't disagree.